Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We're going to talk about protecting our country and protecting its vital interests with our first guest, a man who knows a great deal about both what it takes to defend the United States of America, but also much about its vital interests in the Middle East, and in particular, the place in safeguarding those vital interests that is played by the State of Israel. His name is Dr. David Wormser. He has a long and distinguished record of service in our government as a naval intelligence officer, rising through the ranks to that of lieutenant commander. He has been at the right hand of an undersecretary of state, the national security advisor, and the vice president, successive roles in our government, as well as been a duty expert for institutions like the American Enterprise Institute and our own Center for Security Policy, where these days he runs our Middle East program. David Wormser, there is much mischief being made at the moment in Israel, and I'm very glad to catch up with you to take stock of it and its import, not just for the Jewish state, but for our vital interests as well. Welcome back to Securing America, my friend.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk a little bit about the background, David. There has been, for some weeks now, a fight over so-called judicial reform that the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been pursuing. Where do things stand at the moment?
Sure. I mean, in a nutshell, the judiciary in Israel over the last 30 years has launched a revolution that essentially empowers it above the government, including above the elected parliament. And it has gotten to such an acute level of problem that the government, especially a right-leaning government, but really most governments, found themselves so restricted that they essentially were reduced to an advisory capacity. So there's a broad consensus, not necessarily politically among the parties, but certainly in the population. I believe the latest polls around 80%, that some form of significant reform and overhaul of the judiciary is necessary. So, of course, this new government...
My understanding is, David, if I may interject, that includes even voters on the left feel that way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. If you go through the statements of many of the leaders on the left, they've said things as strongly about the need for judicial reform as has Prime Minister Netanyahu. But this government was elected in part. They campaigned very heavily on the need for judicial reform because it had become so acute. It isn't something that only affects the power of the government. It affects the everyday lives of Israelis. If your son or daughter is serving in the Israeli military, their lives are under a microscope by the legal corps. And the legal corps has decided everything is just justiciable. Everything is a matter for the courts, including operational decisions of the IDF on a micro level. So if you go into
real time, so you're getting second guessing.
So if you're in a hot pursuit and you turn down the wrong alley and you wind up in a disastrous situation, you can be held legally accountable for that decision, especially if the legal counsel said, well, we're not sure there are no civilians there or there's no innocent people. And if they're innocent people, you can't act, blah, blah. So we're talking about granular level that the Supreme Court has inserted.
This is such an important point, David, because as you know, but many of our listeners may not, that virtually everybody in Israel serves in the military. And therefore, this would touch everyone's family, everyone's lives in a way, would it not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a people's army.
Yes.
Everybody serves in the military.
And to the extent that they are second guessing and they are prosecuting and they are otherwise embroiling Israel Defense Forces members in this kind of political agenda of the radical left Supreme Court and its minions, it clearly is, putting constraints on the ability of the people in that military to protect not only themselves, but their country, does it not?
Oh, absolutely. The operational capacity, both on the tactical level and the strategic level, is impaired because the legal decisions are now essentially, the Army now works for the legal bureau. They can only act with the approval of the legal bureau. So it impairs operational capability on every level, including the highest strategic level, like does Israel strike Iran?
Yeah. And I want to come back to that in a moment, David. But just to sort of round out this update on the state of play with this reform, things have reached such a pass with demonstrations and blockages of highways and now a general strike by the transportation sector that the pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu to essentially back away a bit, at least, from this judicial reform initiative of his, which, as you say, was mandated by those in the majority in this recent election in November. It has now proven irresistible, I take it. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one has to understand that it wasn't just the courts who assumed the power. The reason why this was done was because the Israeli left and the entire camp of the left in Israel since 1977 has essentially been losing elections. And all the trend lines in Israel are more and more toward the right, toward more religion, toward more nationalism, toward all these various traditional and traditions, et cetera. It's become more of a Jewish nation in a certain sense. But the elites were grounded in an old secular socialist structure. And while many may not be fully socialists, they still believe in this. We're part of Europe. We are just another European country. We need to be anchored to Europe. So they've lost control of society. So they've retreated into these structures, which have been empowered to be more powerful than the elected structure of Israel. And that way, they continue to rule Israel, essentially, even if they don't win elections. So this reform now cuts into that. It cuts into the rise of an undemocratic or illiberal control over the government of Israel by the left. And so obviously they took to the streets.
Yeah, they've taken to the streets. Right. They've threatened to overthrow the government. There is even talk of effectively a coup against Netanyahu at the moment, even though he's now made these concessions.
I mean, let me be clear. They used refusal to serve in the reserves, and Israel's army is based on reserves. The refusal to serve in reserves, and then increasingly even in the regular army, over the last 24 hours before the weekend started, you started seeing parents refusing to send their kids to serve in the regular army. What they did was they were deliberately damaging the operational capacity of the IDF, of the Israel Defense Forces, in order to hold that operational capacity hostage for the political leverage to shut down the reform that would have disempowered the very increasingly narrowing group of elites. And because Israel faces so many threats right now, that was a very real problem.
Yeah. Again, we're going to take a short break here in just a moment, David, to take stock on that score, the external threats to Israel. But just to wrap this up in 30 seconds, you are now seeing the Prime Minister of Israel back away with a suspension of the effort for judicial reform. Unfortunately, it does not seem as though it is going to end the pressure for his removal. And we're going to talk on the other side of the break first about what is being done to threaten him with criminal penalties, perhaps the government as well. That and much more with David Wormser. Dr. Wormser is our savant on all these matters. Stay tuned for more right after this.
The This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In Israel, radical leftists are literally bringing the country to a standstill to stop the long-needed and reasonable judicial reforms mandated in last November's elections. Blockaded highways and now a general strike by transportation workers are endangering the country's economy and security. The Biden administration, which endlessly professes its commitment to democracy, has been supporting its ideological allies' efforts to block the sorts of governmental checks and balances foundational to our own constitutional republic. It supports those who want the left-dominated Israeli Supreme Court effectively to make elected officials irrelevant and would clearly welcome their toppling of Benjamin Netanyahu's government. Such interference in the internal affairs of our most important regional ally is not only reprehensible, it is also strategically reckless at a time when our mutual enemies are feeling emboldened to renew their efforts to destroy the Jewish state. Stand with Israel. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. Dr. David Wormser is continuing this really important conversation about what is happening in the state of Israel that could prove very perilous to the Jewish state at times such as this. And David Wormser, you were talking a bit about what the court has been doing and an instrument of the court, interestingly enough, namely the Attorney General, to delegitimize, I guess, for want of a better term, the Netanyahu government. Talk quickly about that and where that's likely to lead.
Well, you have a situation, a surreal circumstance, where the Prime Minister of Israel is barred from dealing with some of the most critical questions facing the state of Israel right now. The reason why is that, we could go on for hours about how deep the legal structure has penetrated, but essentially the investigatory arms of the Israeli police are also essentially answerable to the courts. So you have numerous trials that Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, faces, all of which have collapsed essentially, but they've gone on for 2-3 years anyway. They're just perpetual now. And as a result, they say...
Sounds a little like the difficulties of Donald Trump with
investigators and the like. So what's happened here is the judiciary has said, the attorney general, has said, well, you're in the criminal system now. And therefore, any decision or any intervention on any matter of judicial reform is a conflict of interest. So you cannot pronounce, intervene, engage, or even talk about judicial reform. And yet that is the issue tearing the country apart. It's the issue he was elected on. So the surreal circumstance where the prime minister is shut down completely. So the situation had gotten so dangerous that on Thursday, because of the desertions, the threats, by the way, there was a lot of threats of violence and so forth, but the desertions, especially in the military, led to a situation where the prime minister had to speak. And he spoke on Thursday. So instantly, as a result of that, the attorney general has moved now to declare him in criminal violation of his gag order, essentially. And that can drive a process where he will be impeached and removed from office. And so that's a process that will work out in the next few weeks.
Overseen no less by the Supreme Court, which is the...
Which
focus
obviously
of this
is not affected by judicial reform and therefore has no conflict of interest. Exactly. Yeah, no, the irony is, or the hypocrisy is thick enough to cut with a steak knife only. But at any rate, the point is that in the last 24 hours, something else has shifted as well, which is that he fired his defense minister because he felt two things. One, the defense minister did not nip the desertions in the bud early to make it clear this is a red line that cannot be crossed. So now they've mushroomed, they've snowballed. And second of all, he argued because of that snowballing failure, essentially, the government has no choice but to halt the reform package. And the worst thing is he gave a speech publicly saying that while Prime Minister was in London and couldn't respond. So the prime minister lost confidence and fired the defense chief. Well, now the argument and the demonstrations are, oh, they can take reform off the table. That's absolute, but that's not enough. What's enough now is that Netanyahu has proven himself to be so extreme and so out of control that he is unfit for office. He's a clear and present danger, and that the Attorney General and the Supreme Court have to remove him from office.
So, David, if this would be a very, very, I think, dangerous moment, even if Israel were completely at peace and secure. And that is not the case. And I've told our listeners we're going to be talking about Iran. We've only got about 4 minutes to do so, but I want you to visit with us about not just Iran and the dangers that it clearly now poses, the red lines of which you spoke a moment ago, seemingly having been crossed in terms of enough enriched uranium to make bombs. But it's only one of the threats that is now imperiling the state of Israel at this very, very fraught moment. Walk us through it quickly, if you would.
Well, Iran, first of all, has now reached that point where it's essentially a threshold state. The moment it decides to make a bomb, it's weeks away, one or two weeks away. And the Israelis,
it's made that decision some time ago.
Yeah. So the Israelis, I think they have slightly more time, but we're talking about maybe a week or two more time, not a year or two more time. So the Israelis essentially are coming up against a red line on this. They have to act. They believe and they say they have options to take that down. But they're reaching that decision point where they must act. The second thing is because of what's happened regionally, the Israelis no longer have the ability of Iran to be dispersed between a war with the Saudis and the war here and a war there. The Iranians now have zeroed in and focused on the Israelis by shutting down, for the moment, the Houthi war against Saudi Arabia. They'll come back to it, but for the moment, shut down. So all the forces are converging on Israel. So that opens the second front, which is the tentacles of Iran are in an acute conventional conflict, red lines with that as well, with Hezbollah and that. The third area is, of course, Hamas and Islamic Jihad. The Palestinian Authority, and Frank, you and I go back 30 years on this, it was an apparition. It never was real. It never was going to be making peace, and in as much as it had any power. But the truth is, it doesn't even have power now. It is literally dead. So there's a vacuum.
And we've been told by Itamar Marcus on a recent program here, David, there's not a dime's worth of difference between the Palestinian Authority and these terrorist factions when it comes to the actual policy. They may continue to fuzz it up rhetorically in English. But is that your view, too, that the Palestinians are now really of a mind on taking out Israel?
In some ways, the PLO's units are the worst because they're the ones who, because the PLO is so irrelevant, collapsed, they have to assert themselves as legitimate. And the only currency of legitimacy is terror. So they have become very active.
These are outfits that we have armed and trained in many cases. And by day, they may be security forces. By night, they're with the jihadis.
Essentially, the battle over the Palestinians is underway between Hamas, Jihad, and the remaining PLO factions, all of which pay for it in the currency of Jewish blood. So that's a third war that Israel is now in an acute phase. And then the fourth one is internal. The massive arming of Israeli Arabs and the breakdown of law and order over the last 2-3 years. The Israelis now have an internal front to deal with in a war.
And we've actually seen this violently expressing itself. And David, I guess this is the key point, that we're looking at all of these forces converging at a moment when the Israel Defense Forces are, you know, standing down or AWOL, as the case may be. They are clearly having a crisis with respect to who's in charge. And over their shoulders are these lawyers who are apt to try to prosecute them if they do anything they find untoward. And I we have to close with just a minute, David, on what is the Biden administration's contribution to this disaster?
Well, the Biden administration, apart from clearly funding elements of these organizations that were up heating the situation up, has publicly lambasted the Israeli government, lecturing it self-righteously about stability and change and that major things shouldn't be done without consensus. In other words, in a veiled way, they have encouraged this coup attempt, essentially.
Not so veiled, I would suggest.
Not so. And the second thing is the rise of the threats around Israel, which are very much because of the collapse of American power and an intentional policy of dismantling American power, have given the Israelis such a sense of threat that allowed the damage to the operational capacity of the IDF by desertion to be such an overriding issue that the government had to give in. It has to fight with Iran and Hezbollah. It can't tolerate it right now.
We're out of time. We're going to do more of this, folks, on Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at centerforsecuritypolicy.org. I strongly encourage you to join us for a briefing by David Wormser and the great Carolyn Glick. David, thank you. We'll talk to you again on Wednesday. Thanks to all of you for joining us. We'll be right back with more right after this.
In cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Back, and we're joined, as we have the privilege of being most weeks about this time, by Bill Walton, a former master of the universe on Wall Street. He used to run a $6 billion operation called Allied Capital. He is these days the master of The Bill Walton Show, a terrific podcast television program with superb guests and great content. And we are always privileged to be able to benefit a bit from what he's learning and thinking about and talking with his team here at Securing America. Bill, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Frank, I love talking with you.
Thank you. Let me start by asking you about a topic that we turn to with you most weeks, I think it's fair to say now, and that's what's going on in communist China, on the economic side in particular, Bill. It seems as though there's increasing evidence that it's really bad business doing business with the Chinese Communist Party at the moment. Your thoughts?
Well, the working assumption of most of the international community for the last decade has been that investing in China would be easier because the Chinese Communist Party would always want to make China investable in order to attract capital and promote their agenda. Well, that has changed. And I think our friend Gordon Chang talks about the unlimited warfare strategy that China has, and it looks like that's been ongoing now for at least 3 years. And as a part of that, they are no longer welcoming international investors. In fact, they seem to be turning them away. And Exhibit A for that is what's happening with the Evergrande restructuring. Evergrande, as you might recollect, was much in the news last year as the largest real estate firm in the world failed catastrophically after the Chinese Communist Party failed to shore up the capital markets and keep the plate spinning in the real estate investment market. And they were sitting on hundreds of billions of dollars of debt that they couldn't repay. Part of that debt were bonds that were owed largely to international investors. Just this last week, they announced a settlement on those bonds, or a proposed settlement, where international investors will discover that they might get 2 cents on the dollar, maybe 6 cents. Or if they want to take more bonds, they can be paid in interest in the form of additional bonds from Evergrande.
Well, that's an offer you can refuse, right? Yeah. So, Bill, I'm struck by this because it seems as though there's an ongoing effort, certainly by Wall Street, to encourage their clients to invest in China. Is this a question of cognitive dissonance, as they say? They're just not seeing what they don't want to see? Or are they not actually picking up on some of the grim news coming out of China?
Well, China is the most confusing economy to analyze on the planet. I mean, on the one hand, it's ruled with an iron fist by the Chinese Communist Party, totalitarian state. On the other, it's home to more billionaires than any other country in the world, almost 1,000 billionaires. And it has the largest consumer luxury goods market in the world. So what the Wall Street firms and the other multinationals that want to keep doing business in China are seeing is that it's been a great market for them, and they want to keep that going. But it's becoming clear, because of pressure here in the United States, that people like you and others that have really raised with concerns about how much we want to be doing with China, there are fewer and fewer business leaders that are willing to travel there. There's an event this week that, let me see if I can't find
the China Development Forum, I think it's called.
Yeah, the Development Forum. And traditionally, that's been a place where everybody has gathered, running all the big banks and the big multinationals. This year, only Ray Dalio and I think Tim Cook, who runs Apple, will be attending. And so we're seeing some ebbing of that enthusiasm, but at the same time, I think, as I told you a couple of weeks ago, Morgan Stanley still got a buy signal on the Chinese market. So, you know, my advice is stay away. I mean, there's you're depending on the good graces of the Chinese Communist Party for everything you do there, and you cannot count on that.
Yeah. And in that regard, there's been a raid on a Western, I guess, a U.S. company that is in the due diligence business. Obviously, they're not interested in having people do due diligence in China. But again, the signals seem to be that they are, you know, indifferent to the conclusion that people might draw that, just as you say, it's time to stay away from China.
Well, this one's really interesting because it raided a group called the Mintz Group, which is a due diligence and investigations firm. And I've worked with many of those when I was in the private equity business, the investment business. And what you do when you go into a deal is you ask one of these firms to investigate the company, the people, the markets, and maybe most importantly, whether there's anything fishy going on with their track record. And Mintz Group was one of the leading companies in the world, or at least in China. It has almost 18 offices around the world, and they have a lot of information in their files that the Chinese Communist Party could find very useful about the personal lives of people doing business in China and elsewhere, really worldwide. And it's interesting that they raid the firm this week, because it's the same week that conference is going on. And to me, that sends a signal that the Chinese Communist Party just doesn't care how we feel about what they're doing, and they're battening down the hatches for a larger conflict.
Well, that's the point of our recent webinar, Bill, as you know, the Committee on the Present Danger China, which you can find, folks, again, at presentdangerchina.org, is if they are battening the hatches, if they are, in fact, hunkering down, if they are preparing for conflict, these are the sorts of things you would expect to see them do.
And there's a pattern.
It's troubling, to say the least. Bill, one other tell that I wanted to get your take on is that the Chinese apparently are actually signaling that they expect very low growth this year. Again, one can't trust their data as far as you can throw it, but what do you make of the fact that they seem to be owning up to the prospect that this is going to be a tough year?
Well, I think this is part of the picture they're painting of about China. And historically, China's always shown that it wants to project rosy growth, 10%, 12% every year was routine for the past 15, 20, 25 years. And this year, the central bankers, the central policymakers in China have announced a 5% growth rate, which is by far the lowest they've announced. And normally that would be, they would worry that would be scaring off international investment, but they don't seem to care. And so they just put the real number out. And of course it's up. Last year, they're claiming the economy grew at 3%. I doubt that. We can't trust the statistics. Remember, they had the zero COVID policy totally enforced, and they were preventing people to come into the country. My guess is they shrunk last year. But you know, the Chinese numbers we've never really believed. They're only directional. And I think, as you point out, the signal here is that they're willing to say, look, it's lower growth. And so if you don't want to come in to invest, we don't need you anyway.
I hope the message will be not lost on Wall Street and on those American investors who we fear will stand to lose everything if there is, in fact, a conflict with China.
Yeah.
Bill, I wanted to ask you about the CEO of TikTok's testimony before the Congress earlier this past week. It was quite a performance, I think, and I'd be interested in your take on where things go from here.
Well, it was wonderful theater, and all the congressmen, all the people, and got to grandstand and say terrible things about China and TikTok and our privacy and things like that. But
on both sides of the aisle,
But you know, I viewed this as kabuki theater. This was exactly the kind of thing we thought. And that young CEO, he almost had to feel sorry for him because he was hung out to dry by the party officials. Taking the heat. But the question is, is there gambling going on in this casino? Yeah. I mean, have the Chinese had access to our information through TikTok? Absolutely. Did we just find that out with this hearing? No, we've known this for a long time. The issue before us right now is there are 150 million users of TikTok in America, and a disproportionate of the number of those users are young people, so-called Gen Z and millennials. And the stunning thing, Frank, is they just don't seem to care about national security or issues with China. And they see this as sort of more or less of a generation gap where these old politicians are telling them bad things about their favorite app. The other issue we've got here is that TikTok is now generating $7 or $8 billion in profits from sponsorship and ad revenues. Okay, we say, well, that all goes to TikTok, but that's not really the point. The point is sponsors and advertisers find it an incredibly valuable platform. And so their constituencies to keep this going include the companies that want to advertise, and also the kids who just don't see an issue. When you tell them, gosh, guys, there's some issue about personal privacy or propaganda, they don't seem to care. Although
the one issue that does seem to resonate certainly
leaves you open to blackmail, because you got a packet, you got a pattern of use on TikTok that.
Bill, I have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you for your time today, my friend, and for your insights into all of this. We'll be talking more about where we go from here with Kevin in a moment. God bless you. We'll talk to you next week. Stay tuned for more right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In Israel, radical leftists are literally bringing the country to a standstill to stop the long-needed and reasonable judicial reforms mandated in last November's elections. Blockaded highways and now a general strike by transportation workers are endangering the country's economy and security. The Biden administration, which endlessly professes its commitment to democracy, has been supporting its ideological allies' efforts to block the sorts of governmental checks and balances foundational to our own constitutional republic. It supports those who want the left-dominated Israeli Supreme Court effectively to make elected officials irrelevant and would clearly welcome their toppling of Benjamin Netanyahu's government. Such interference in the internal affairs of our most important regional ally is not only reprehensible, it is also strategically reckless at a time when our mutual enemies are feeling emboldened to renew their efforts to destroy the Jewish state. Stand with Israel. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. He is Kevin Freeman, the proprietor of another television program, as it happens. His is called Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. He is a friend and colleague now of many years, a man we have come to rely on as our duty expert here at Securing America and also at the Center for Security Policy on matters involving economic warfare, notably, but not exclusively, that being waged against us relentlessly by the Chinese Communist Party. He's the author of a number of important books, Secret Weapon, Game Plan, and According to Plan, as well as a prodigious thinker and generator of actionable ideas. And we're going to talk with him about a couple of them that are very much worth noting. Before we do, though, Kevin, I want to say, first of all, welcome. Good to have you with us, as always.
Thank you.
And secondly, I want to say I'm anxious to get your take on a topic that we touched on with our previous guest, Bill Walton, concerning the events of last week in which the CEO of a company called, a platform called TikTok, testified before the Congress and was rather thoroughly beaten up for about 5 hours over the dangers that his product constitutes in our country. I know you were tracking this. You have done a program, I think, on it recently. Talk a little bit about where are we with this particular Chinese economic and strategic weapon of unrestricted warfare.
Well, Frank, as you mentioned, there were these hearings, and we saw some of the best dancing with the stars that you could ever see, because the CEO of TikTok was dancing around every serious question. I mean, questions come up, are you giving your data to China? And he would dance around it. The reality of it is the data does go to China. Are you controlled by the Chinese Communist Party? He danced around it. If you're a company that does business in China, a Chinese company, then you are controlled by China, the Chinese Communist Party. These are all facts and realities, and both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans, acknowledge them. I mean, it's something that we've talked about for close to a decade, Frank, about the risk of the Chinese Communist Party and how they control the corporations there. And, you know, what we see as a marketplace, our enemies view as a battle space. And they've clearly weaponized this incredible social media platform, not only to brainwash people, but also to spy and gather data. All of that is seemingly true based on these hearings.
Seemingly true and profoundly troubling, because in addition to what we've been increasingly hearing about, Kevin, as you know, in terms of the access to huge quantities of personal information, including possibly DNA and other health-related data that the Chinese are hoovering up from their users and putting into their, you know, awesome artificial intelligence algorithms and big data, you know, management and parsing. They also use this platform relentlessly to propagandize, particularly impressionable young Americans. And I know that was touched on by some of the people questioning this fellow, but it certainly doesn't seem to be one of those things that could be easily addressed simply by having, you know, new management, new ownership of the enterprise, as long as the Chinese are anywhere in the mix. Talk to us a little bit about this propagandizing, Kevin, and how it now seems to be translating into not only a huge market, by some estimates, 150 million users, but also a loyalty to the brand that might prove very problematic for politicians who are trying to do the right thing by, well, both these users and our national security.
Well, first off, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal today. I've got the headline, "Americans pull back from values that once defined U.S. Patriotism, religion, and hard work hold less importance." I had this sent to me by a mutual friend who said, "Isn't this what the Chinese want?" And I said, "It's not just what they want, it's what they've been working towards." The entire purpose of every propaganda effort from the Chinese Communist Party is to undermine faith in the United States and patriotism, religion, and hard work. And we see that from unrestricted warfare. TikTok does exactly that. And yes, you're right. Politicians may find it very difficult because they're a segment of our population, particularly young people, so addicted to TikTok, they call it digital crack, or that they would prefer to watch their videos and to stay tuned to it. And you watch the mindless zombies just flipping through these things and watching. So you're correct. That doesn't change the problem or what we have to do about it. Just imagine if you said a drug dealer's on the streets and everybody likes the drug, but it ultimately is going to end in their demise. You'd say, well, we got to get them off the streets. We have to do it. What's worse, though, this isn't a drug dealer trying to make a profit. This is a drug dealer that wants to tear down and destroy the entire country in which he's operating. So, yes, if this is CCP propaganda, we've got to get it out of the hands of our young people because it's highly effective in destroying our values.
It is indeed. You know, the question is this operation too big to derail? And I'm with you, Kevin. I think it can't be. We simply can't afford it as a nation. When you talk, Kevin, about the way forward, what do you envision will be done here? Is it going to be sufficient unto the day, as they say, to have new ownership, removing it from the so-called ByteDance parent company that is Chinese and Chinese Communist Party controlled?
Well, I think psychologists will tell us, neuroscientists will tell us that the means of which they are connecting with people is actually quite damaging in itself. So there's going to have to be a scientific review. There's going to have to be a technology review and so forth. The way that you do it is you defang it and you have to take away those crack-oriented features that are causing such addictions. Because they're not fair. It's unfair commerce. It's unfair in every respect, and we should pull it from that kind of technology.
It's the digital equivalent of what they're doing to us with their fentanyl infusions, and it's absolutely lethal. You're absolutely right about that, Kevin, and look forward to following closely with you the next steps and how we can support people trying to do the right thing about TikTok. We'll be right back with more with Kevin Freeman on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned. Welcome back. Kevin Freeman is in the house, I'm pleased to say, the proprietor of his own television program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, which, among other things, makes available absolutely spectacularly important battle plans. And you can find out much more about all of this at economicwarroom.com. Kevin, I wanted to pivot a little bit, stay with China. It is, of course, topic A for us most days. But talk a little bit about what is now looming on the horizon in terms of another export, another toxic export, I would call it, namely their social credit system. We've been introducing our audience for some time now to this idea that they're using a multinational organization they effectively control, called the World Health Organization, to try to socialize the idea of not only having, you know, global governance take over and surrender our sovereignty to it, but also to have increasingly reliance on, in this case, universal digital health cards as a means of assuring compliance with whatever mandates we get from the World Health Organization. Talk to us a little bit about how all of this can translate, especially if combined with something called central bank digital currencies, into effectively the same kind of totalitarian control mechanism that they've instituted inside communist China, the social credit system.
Well, certainly. The social credit scores, particularly tied to the vaccine passports, the digital passports, gives you effective 100% control, and it even gives you the ability to find the person who says, I'm going completely off grid, I don't care about your money, I'm going to go live on my own land, and I'm going to produce my own food and live by myself. No, no, we have to knock on your door because you are a conveyor of disease, and therefore we have a right to control you, your family, and everyone around you. So that is an essential component to a complete totalitarian control. The Chinese have used it. They locked people in their buildings. They, you know, for, if you show up at your bank because there's a run on your bank in China, they turn your health passport code red, and therefore you're required to be isolated, quarantined, and you have to leave immediately. So having that World Health Organization, but it goes beyond that. The World Health Organization, the proposals that they have, give the that body the ability to tell you whether or not you have a gas-burning stove in your house because it's a health crisis, or whether you're driving a gasoline-powered car, or whether whatever activity that you're doing is maybe a threat to someone else's health, therefore we can control you. It's like putting a straitjacket on you unless you go along with the system. And that's the point of those of the WHO, which has been captured almost entirely by the Chinese Communist Party, and their purpose working with the Biden administration would be then to propagate all of that throughout America and take away the control of the health of the citizens, which is at the state level, and give it to an international body.
Yeah, moving us completely away from both the constitutional protections we enjoy, but also from the idea of federalism, the governance by the you know, the people most accountable. This is just turning on its head, I think, our entire system, and a very dangerous deal, especially as it's coming, Kevin, at a time when we're seeing, you mentioned Chinese banks, difficulties in our own banking system. As we speak, First Citizens has just bought, apparently, the now notorious Silicon Valley Bank.
The assets, yes.
The assets thereof. And what we're hearing is that there's likely going to be more of these kinds of transitions taking place inside American banking systems. And I just wonder, how does that tie in, as you see it, Kevin, to the threat of this central bank digital currency, and what can we do about it?
Well, Frank, as you know, I began in the national security space with economic warfare back in 2008 when there was a run on the banks, Bear Stearns and Lehman and so forth, Washington Mutual, all the big banks. Problems that we had in 2008 came from foreign financial terrorism, at least in part. There are elements of potentially foreign financial terrorism here. Certainly, there are elements here of a power grab opportunity. Whenever you see a deer in your sights, a hunter feels compelled to take a shot. And right now, our banking system, for a whole lot of reasons, is a weakness there that I believe the federal government and foreign governments are trying to take advantage of, again, to institute totalitarian control. So we have a problem with the banking system. Well, we'll just give you central bank digital currency. It'd be all electronic. We can control it. What they really mean is they can control you. They can determine whether or not you can buy or sell. They can determine what you can buy and sell. And they can track you, whatever you're doing with your monetary purchases, much more than they're doing with the credit cards now. And it's pretty scary what they can do with the credit card now. But they're going to issue this digital currency like the Chinese have done. It's coming fast down the tracks. FedNow is going to be released in July. FedNow is the superhighway on which the digital dollar will operate. So it's in an instantaneous payment transfer system so they can monitor everything that you're doing.
And Kevin, this sounds pretty frightening. I know you have been championing in your native state of Texas and elsewhere for that matter, an approach that might give us some protection from this so-called central bank digital currency trap. Talk a little bit about it, if you would.
Certainly. In the Constitution, the founders said that the federal government, the Congress, has the power to coin money. And the Congress has given that power to the Treasury and to the Federal Reserve System. They're the ones building the central bank digital currency. But they also left a provision that said that no state shall make anything other than gold and silver coins tender within that state. In other words, states can still operate on a gold and silver economy. So we have a bullion depository in Texas that can accept gold and silver. We want to attach an ATM machine to the side of it so the average citizen can transact business using gold and silver coins. You can learn more about that at economicwarroom.com, but it is an alternative, as an escape hatch from CBDC.
And you've got bills in both the House and the Senate in the state legislature of Texas. We will be monitoring closely, with your help, Kevin, how that's going and the urgent need for an alternative to the Fed's now taking over our currency and our lives is absolutely imperative. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. And until then, go forth and multiply.